This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, bringing you conversations with the people shaping San Luis Obispo and the greater Central Coast. I'm Monica Lopez. This week, we're exploring how music, storytelling, and environmental leadership are bringing our communities together. First, we'll hear from the Master Chorale's Outreach Committee about the power of choral music to connect people and inspire participation. Next, local author Chris Blake shares his journey of searching for meaning and connection in his new book, Searching for a God to Love. And finally, we'll talk with leaders from Cal Poly's Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience about their work to support regenerative agriculture and climate solutions through the Zero Food Print Program. Stay with us for these inspiring stories from the Central Coast.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. I'm so excited today to have some very special people with me who are with the Master Chorale. They're going to tell you all about that and probably encourage you to join them. I have Brian Lawler and Allison Stewart who are with the Outreach Committee of the Master Chorale. Brian, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Great. Allison, great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, let's start with you telling us, what is the Master Chorale?
The Master Chorale is an organization of between 100 and 120 volunteer singers. We actually pay to sing, and we come from all over the county, and that would include from Paso Robles and even people coming up from Santa Maria. We've had people come up from Lompoc. We are singers from ages in their 20s into their 80s. We come from very diverse backgrounds. Some of us are working, some of us are students, some of us are retired. We join together to produce choral works, master choral works that are generally accompanied by an orchestra. They require significant amount of rehearsal time, but we blend together to produce an amazing, joyful sound in collaboration with our director. And basically, it's sort of a community that's created for the purposes of singing together and producing live choral performance.
That sounds wonderful. So what was the thing that made this come about? How did it just happen?
Tom Davies is our conductor. He was a professor at Cal Poly for over 30 years. He was the choral conductor at Cal Poly. And he had choirs at Cal Poly. Mm-hmm. And midway through his career at Cal Poly, he started the Master Chorale and decided to take it off campus, interestingly, because he wanted to be able to bring in people from the community at large. So he made an arrangement with Cuesta College to make choral group into a class. And so people who wanted to sing in the Master Chorale would enroll in a class at Cuesta College, and it was, you know, minimum fee, like $25 per semester. Oh. And then you could sing in the chorus. And that lasted for, I want to say, more than 25 years, maybe 30 years. And it grew significantly over that time, up to the point where he was having, you know, he had choirs of 75 to 80 singers, and it was becoming a big deal. Uh-huh. And so at some point, they decided to break from Cuesta College in a friendly way and set up a nonprofit organization and take the choir public, so to speak. And the choir has grown also to, as Allison said, depending on the pieces that we're performing. Right now we have 100, but in the springtime we had 120.
Members of the choir?
Yeah, the choir. Wow. And it can be big. Uh-huh. So in springtime we performed Verdi's Requiem, and that's 120 piece, uh-huh. 120 voice piece. And Tom will raise and lower the number of singers according to the pieces that we're singing. And then almost always we sing with a full orchestra. But after the group went public and became a charitable organization, we also moved our center of operations from Cuesta College down to St. Paul's Catholic Church in Pismo Beach, where we rehearse. And we also moved our performances into the Performing Arts Center at Cal Poly.
And what type of music are you singing? Where are you getting the music? Who decides what to sing?
Tom does.
Okay.
It's his decision.
All right.
We sing what you could call the great works, the big works. almost everything we sing is with full orchestra, and full orchestra is more than 50 players. Mm-hmm. So last spring, for example, 120 singers and 155 in the orchestra. It was really extraordinary. Sometimes it'll be even more when he adds additional specialist musicians to the group, more horns, for example. Mm-hmm. So he brought in 3 or 4 or 5 more brass players in the spring concert than we had, because there are parts in the Verdi that call for that. But he's the one who makes the decisions. And so those are works by people most of the time that our audiences know. We sing Mozart, we sing Verdi, we've sung Rachmaninoff, we've sung Haydn, we've sung, sort of the greats. Mm-hmm. And but we also sing less known mm-hmm. singers. So, for example, in our upcoming concert, we're singing a piece by a woman named Amy Beach, who is an American composer who died in 1920, if I remember correctly. She was an inspiration to her generation, one of the real breakthrough women composers of the early 20th century, and her work is exemplary of that era. Mm-hmm. So we're doing that, and we're also playing some Dvorak, which is a similar era, a little bit earlier, and we're doing one piece of Mozart.
And sometimes, don't you commission some works from local artists?
Exactly right. So mm-hmm. that's another very important mission of the chorale, is to engender new compositions by local composers. We've performed some marvelous pieces, particularly by a fellow named Craig Russell. But most recently, there's a professor and composer at Cal Poly, Meredith Brandmeier. Part of our 40th anniversary last year, we commissioned a piece from her that we performed. Quite an extraordinary work. And we're also singing one of her pieces at our upcoming winter concert as well. So we want to encourage people here in the area to realize that we have not only a great performing arts community, but we actually have the ability to come up with amazing new compositions.
Do you find that because your singers are from the community that it makes people more excited to come and hear the master chorale, because they might be seeing someone they actually know in
Absolutely.
The chorale?
Exactly mm-hmm. right.
I was at the grocery store one day, and this man came up to me and said, "I enjoyed your concert the other night." And I said, "Oh, wow, thank you. It was lovely. I'm glad you were there." You know, and this was not a person I knew. Mm-hmm. And he said, "My daughter was the soprano soloist." And I said, "Oh, you know," and he introduced himself. Wow. And he said, "Most people, you know, called me by his first name, and I'm sorry, I don't remember it." He said, "But everybody usually refers to me as the soloist's dad."
Oh.
And so I thought that was pretty cool.
That is
Amy's
cool.
dad.
Right. Yeah, that is cool. So people are actually personally influenced by the fact that they're looking at their neighbors and friends singing in the chorale. How do you think that makes a difference than having, you know, people come from out of town, we go and we hear them, but here we see our people here?
Right. Well, that's one part of the point that we have, in the sense that we have all ages of people in the chorale. We also have people from, again, many different walks of life. Unlike a professional choral organization where they're getting paid and this is sort of their job, what you're looking at are people who are doing this simply from the joy of singing. And I think that's an infectious aspect as well, is that this is much more about giving back to the community rather than doing this as a sort of a job. It's a collaboration with our audience and with the wider community.
That's fantastic. And if you're just joining us, this is the Nonprofit Story. I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and I'm speaking today with Brian Lawler and Allison Stewart, who are on the Outreach Committee for the Master Chorale. So let me ask you, what is the process of joining the chorale?
Joining is by audition. There are auditions every fall, and I think emergency auditions in spring. But Tom will usually a week or two before our regular rehearsal schedule begins, so that would be probably mid-September. And he posts that on the website, and also we make it public with our flyers and advertising. And anyone who would like to audition is welcome to. Mm-hmm. The audition process is like auditioning for any choral group. He asks people to bring a prepared piece to sing, and piano accompaniment is available. Mm-hmm. And also he will give you a piece, he'll hand you a piece to sing on the spot or play something on the piano that he'll ask you to follow. And then he makes judgments based on how many spaces he has in each section. You asked earlier about the sections. There are 16 tenors, for example.
Mm-hmm.
and there are, I don't know how many altos, 500?
Oh, my.
No. There
sometimes
are probably,
it feels like it.
There are probably 30.
Okay.
And so, but that's because the music is balanced that way. Tom understands that, of course, better than any of us, and he builds the choir to fit the music. And so when he's auditioning, he's not only considering the voices and the quality, but he's considering how they fit into the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. So once people join, do you help them musically? In other words, do you help them with developing their voices more? Or are you looking for people who are already there before they come?
I would say that we're looking for people who are already there. It's not really a time for lessons so much. It's assumed that you not only can read music, but generally that you can sight read music fairly well and that you're prepared to go home and rehearse on your own assiduously, I would have to say.
Yeah, there are hours invested
in
this.
Yeah, because we are doing fairly complex works with a fairly short, tight rehearsal schedule in terms of preparation. We're expected to go home and spend, you know, some time every day listening and rehearsing on our own. So I would say that, yeah, it is expected that you have prior choral experience, hopefully some vocal training.
That's wonderful. Well, this sounds like a musical organization that's kind of different from what you might hear normally, people coming in from out of the area and being there. You are people of the area. So how do you measure your impact? You know, not just in ticket sales and attendance and all, but how do you feel like your music might touch the community in a different way maybe than another outside group would?
That's an interesting one. I like to think that we create buzz. You create a, you know, when I say to somebody that I sing in the San Luis Obispo Master Chorale, often they'll say, oh, yeah, I attended your concert last year when you did the Requiem. Or, you know, it's the sort of thing that makes you feel like you've really accomplished something. And it's tough. You mentioned that we, you know, it's not like groups coming from outside. Now, San Luis Obispo County and adjoining is, of course, has a wealth of musical organizations. We've got the Symphony, we've got Symphony Novo, we've got Master Chorale, we've got Vocal Arts, we've got Canzona, we've got the North County Choir, and there's a tremendous amount of concert performance, orchestral music being performed. Master Chorale fits in a little bit differently than the others. First of all, it's all local. Now, not to say that the Symphony isn't, but it's all local. And we do put together an almost entirely a local orchestra too. So it's like you said earlier in the interview, you're singing with people who are playing the viola who are neighbors.
Yes.
And you know, I was at a party a few weeks ago and I met a fellow who plays viola in our orchestra, and we were talking about the fact that I always see the back of his head while we're singing, which is, you know, funny to talk about at a party. But they are really, in fact, members of the community. We're all part of the community, and we do works that are not done by other groups. Almost never, for example, would you see choral music with the San Luis Obispo Symphony, and that probably that trend will be broken next year. They're talking about doing a big choral work. That's fine, because it might end up being us. So we do fit a piece of the bigger musical picture in this county, and we like to think that it's a very, very important piece, because choral music adds tremendous depth to the repertoire that is offered in the community.
That's wonderful. And there's something else here I think that was really important that I had been aware of here, that some of the times your singers say that being involved helps in a mental health, it's a mental health benefit of working together in this type of a situation, and their families and friends are hearing them sing and singing things. Tell us a little bit more about that. I think that's a really important aspect of being involved with Master Chorale.
Absolutely. I find that singing, particularly in a big group like this, there's a community that's built amongst the singers, which is very important. There's also this focus of attention and energy that's unlike nothing else that I'm aware of, where when you're actually standing there singing, you can't do anything else. Your worries, everything else that's going on in the world evaporates because your focus is entirely on producing this perfect noise, as it were, and it gives one such a great sense of peace and joy. The other aspect of that is there's a dynamic between the audience and the chorale, which is why the aspect that we do perform live is so important. There's a lot of recorded choral works out there, mm-hmm. but there is nothing like hearing a live performance, and the energy that the audience feeds is intrinsic to that. I'll mention one other thing, in fact, in what we do that gives back to the community is that each holiday season upcoming in December, we have a traditional concert where we have a sing-along Messiah.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
Everyone is invited to come.
Mm-hmm.
We provide programs, and no matter what your skill level, you can join with us. And Tom literally conducts the audience in this respect rather than us. So we sing, I would say, the greatest hits out
of the
Messiah.
We do the big choruses.
The big choruses yeah. that everyone would know, like the Hallelujah Chorus. And everyone is invited to stand and sing along. And the excitement and rapture that you see on the faces of people in joining along and producing this glorious noise is really quite remarkable. That has grown exponentially over the years and is now a sellout every year, because once people come, they want to do it every year. And what's so great about this is that they bring their kids, and the kids get to experience that standing in the pack with, you know, a couple thousand people and everyone singing along. Whether they really know it or not is very unimportant, because the word is just hallelujah, right?
That's
everybody
amazing.
Can sing that.
That's an amazing yeah. situation, and I hope more people understand that. You know, there's something else here, is that you do try to bring people to your concerts, perhaps offering some tickets to some of the nonprofit organizations that can bring a different, diverse audience in. Is that still something that happens?
Yeah, this is very important to us. Again, we would like more people to come from different parts of our community. And so we've realized that going to concerts is not inexpensive. There's no way to get around it. It's quite the luxury for quite a number of people, particularly those on fixed income. And so we were very fortunate last year to receive a grant from the Performing Arts Center as part of their DEI program. And we used that to reach out to some organizations that serve underserved communities locally, like Big Brothers Big Sisters, HASLO, the Diversity Coalition, and ask them whether there would be people within their purview that might be interested in attending. Mm-hmm. And there were. And so we gave away last year 50 tickets through this grant. And the mm-hmm. feedback that we got was just amazing. Oh, there were people that had never been able to go to the PAC for anything before mm-hmm. that came to the concerts. There were people that whose children had never heard any sort of live orchestral or choral music before. So mm-hmm. that's part of what we're trying to do. So we're keeping that going. We're no longer going to be receiving that grant, but we're now raising money ourselves. So it's something that if people feel that they're interested in attending and they just know that there's no way that they can come, they need to reach out to us and let us know, because we want to support that.
You know, as we get ready to finish, it just sounds to me like you're not only concerned with the music, you're concerned with the people
exactly.
that get to hear the music. What do you think is that emotional impact on people that actually hear your music through the Master Chorale?
I've seen it in their faces. Mm. When, for example, this last year, when we were doing the sing-along Messiah component of our holiday concert, I could see many of the people in the auditorium because they turn the lights up so you can read the score. Mm. And so in that respect, and you see people who are, you know, you can tell who the singers are, meaning who the people who know the music are. And it's fun to watch it because it's like rapture to see them singing, and it makes you feel good. Now, of course, it makes them feel good, too, and
right.
that's a big part of it. And mixed in with that, we like to open our doors, so to speak. We want to bring in young people, too. And so, for example, another thing where Allison and our committee have worked very hard, is to expand our reach, to reach high school students. And last year, we were able to support the Paso Robles High School Choir with a cash grant that we raised among our own singers to help them get to Carnegie Hall and take their choral program to Carnegie. And what do we get in exchange? We get exposure to high school age students, but we also start to see them in our audience. And they understand as a result of this, which is what we really are, this is what outreach means to me. We want to show young singers that they can be singers for their whole careers, their whole lives. And if they sing in high school, it doesn't stop. They can sing forever.
That's amazing.
And they can become a part of this, especially if they're, you know, if they want to join the Master Chorale or Vocal Arts or Canzona or one of the other choral groups in the community. Those eyes are opened and those ears are exposed to something that they may not have considered in the past. So it's an opportunity for us to extend our reach to young people so that we start to see more age diversity. And Allison mentioned it. We have 20-somethings in our group, and we also have 80-somethings in our groups. I don't know what the mean is, but it's it has been over the last, let's just say, 20 years that I've been involved, an aging group of people. But now, interestingly, we're starting to see more and more college-age students specifically, and that's tending to bring the average age down, which improves the quality of our music and also extends our reach to a greater audience.
That's fantastic. So if people want to know more about you, what is your website?
It's slomastercorral.org.
Wonderful. And we have been having a wonderful time speaking today about the Master Chorale with Brian Lawler and Allison Stewart, who are on the Outreach Committee of the Master Chorale. Please get to their website, learn more about them, and start attending those concerts and maybe become a part of the Master Chorale. This is Consuelo Mutes, and this is The Nonprofit Story. Thank you.
Hello, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author Chris Blake, whose book Searching for a God to Love has just been issued in an updated edition. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write the book?
Wow. Yeah, that's the name of the book is Searching for a God to Love. And I spent a long time searching, including when I came to Cal Poly in 1969, ended up playing basketball here as a point guard for 4 years. And after I graduated, I continued searching for this God. And this is not a memoir, the book. It's really about a lot of different approaches and some things I found that kept me away from loving God. And so those are put in narrative forms, a lot of stories in the book, but the idea of this changed my life, falling in love with God.
Wow, that's impressive. In your bio, you note that you've been a high school teacher, a nationally award-winning magazine editor, a pastor, and a communications professor. I'm just going to hit you with a left something out of left field. Which of those did you enjoy the most?
Oh, wow. I think probably professor, yeah. I was a professor in Lincoln, Nebraska, a little college called Union College for 24 years. And I loved interacting with students, especially.
Isn't it fun? One of my favorite things on earth is sitting down with a young person and getting to know them and finding out what moves them and what their worries are, what their hopes are. It's always refreshing, especially if I'm a little bit down in the dumps. When you came to speak to our Rotary Club a couple months ago, the title of your talk was Tips on Difficult Conversations, Politics, and Peace. I thought it was a fascinating presentation, and I think your book ties into it on many levels. But what's the gist of your message in a speech like that on how to have difficult conversations in this day and age?
Yeah, the idea is that we engage in active listening with love. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. said, whom you would change, you must first love. And so love is the basis for dialogue in a world that's sorely in need of it right now. So the idea is listening to others, listening to God, and listening to ourselves as well, because sometimes we don't hear what we're saying as well as what others are saying. And active listening is paraphrasing, it's focusing, and communicating in ways that ennoble both the people who are involved.
People I admire, actually, in this case, in the religious field, Father John Deere, Father Greg Boyle, talk about peace as a goal that we have, and pointing out that it really needs to start with oneself. One has to be aware of oneself. Mm-hmm. One has to forgive and love oneself,
yes,
as a starting point, because I just don't see how it could happen otherwise, at least not, and be authentic. But psychologists point out that most of what happens in our daily lives is subconscious, maybe 10 to 15% if we're lucky, of our bodily and mental processes are we aware of and conscious of. The rest of it is happening, but below our radar. What are some things you've learned in your research and your activities, your jobs, to where people can become more self-aware and start that peaceful process, but with themselves?
Yeah. to truly listen to others is, in my view, to find some commonalities. When I was a magazine editor, we took on some very controversial topics, and I would get really incendiary letters sometimes, this was last millennium, from people that were upset with me. And so I remember this one guy wrote a letter and he called me a spawn of Satan. that was my favorite. And so I always tried to call him back. I always tried to contact these people. You can't always do that, and sometimes rarely. But putting a name to things and getting actual dialogue, not just this virtual taking pot shots behind anonymity, I think is really important. I remember this one in particular. When I called him, I said, "Hi, this is Chris Blake, editor of Insight Magazine." There's a long pause, you know, and then we chatted. You know, we found some places where we agreed. We had some laughs. And then I said, "Now, about this spawn of Satan thing." And he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh," I said, "you know, my parents are going to be very surprised, first of all." But
it will cause him to look inward.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. What am I doing here? What am I saying, and how am I sounding? But the whole object of life, in my view, is love. There's no motive that matters other than love, no legacy that lasts. So the idea is to become better lovers in a way that, you know, enables God and ennobles us.
You know, you mentioned that this episode happened in the last millennium.
Yeah.
Which would be when the internet was just coming online to be a big force in our lives. Yeah. I'm sure you've seen this phenomenon that, as I have. I've heard some of these people who basically professional whiners called keyboard warriors.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the spite, the you know, the vitriol and the anonymity, they all seem to go hand in hand, is partly a creature of internet communications. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. To me, internet is like electricity. It's a power that can be, because, you know, we can die from electricity, and it also can enhance our lives in so many ways. And I think right now there are a lot of dangers. One of them is, which I faced with my students, especially toward the end, was the addiction to, you know, this virtual reality. To have virtual friends is not to have actual friends, in my view.
Right, yeah. Right. I always used to say that we crave friendships. We need them more than ever, and we hope that acquaintance, which is what service clubs like Rotary are dedicated to, in many cases can lead to friendship and be a fundamental reason why people come to a service club, for example, or take part in community efforts, is to be with like-minded friends. But one of the things I learned in my cognitive psych classes is that the vast majority of content when we communicate with each other is nonverbal.
Yes.
Specifically, we're sitting here in the studio and we're talking, but I'm looking at you, we're nodding, We have our body language and so forth. We're attentive that's in each right. other's presence. And that's right. just not possible on the internet that I understand.
No. Yeah, body language is so important. One of my favorite quotes is Robert Louis Stevenson, who said, "The cruelest lies are often told in silence." Times when we should speak up, times when maybe somebody raises an eyebrow when they shouldn't. But to be able to read that and to assess and respond is important. So, yeah, the body language. I used to teach even handwriting analysis a little bit, too. So many things come through who we are and what we do. It's fascinating.
One of my favorite things in life is telling strange jokes. I call my sense of humor bent, yeah. sometimes a little bit salty, but just odd, coming from a weird point of view, and it's just my personality. And humor doesn't work on the internet very well. More often than not, I think an attempted humor is misunderstood and yeah. winds up not only being unfunny, but worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Humor is difficult anyway. I have a section in my book on humor, and I remember one friend saying, you know, you should have left that out. So apparently he didn't find it very funny, although I did.
Yeah.
I definitely found it funny. Yeah. And if you need me to read one of those jokes, I'm prepared to do so.
Yeah, I'm the king of bad jokes sometimes. I'd like to remind everybody that I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author Chris Blake, who's written a book called Searching for a God to Love. We're talking about that book and also how to weave some of those lessons in the book into our daily lives by way of getting to know ourselves better, our friends better, and our business relationships and so forth. Your theme, as you've written in your bio also, is active listening with love, mm-hmm. which I think are two related but different things. And what would you say would be a very common misconception about your message?
Yeah. Common misconception is that acceptance means agreement. Yeah, just because we accept somebody, accept their worth, accept the that they are a child of God, doesn't mean that we agree with them on everything. And even accepting a message, in essence, doesn't necessarily have to mean that. So I think that's one primary misconception. It's in line also with to forgive somebody doesn't mean you agree with what they did. It was probably very wrong, but it means you release yourself
right.
from that imprisonment that unforgiveness brings. As Anne Lamott pointed out, she says, not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die.
Wow. That's pretty bold. I was reading a long time ago. I'm a boards person, being a former librarian, and I always wanted to be charming to people because I thought that was a cool thing, like in conversation around the table or at a counter in a mom and pop greasy spoon. Doesn't matter, but I want to be charming to others. And of course, charming, the literal definition is to be under a magical spell. And the magical spell between two people when someone is charming just takes one of the people being open to listening, mm-hmm. their eyes focused on their counterpart, their body language attentive like we are today.
Yeah.
It's not difficult, but I think too often we don't avail ourselves of that tool to be charming with others. And it has so much to do, I think, with the point of your book, the loneliness and the people's desire to be heard.
Yes.
In fact, some of the points you make in your book are about the various. I want to talk a little bit about the different ways or modalities of prayer, and then also listening. Because if you think of prayer, that's probably something coming from us outward, and listening is the reverse, inward. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I view prayer much as breathing, inhaling and exhaling. In fact, inspiration is about breathing in. And so most of the time when people pray, they're spending 95% of their time exhaling, telling God how things are down here, and 5% maybe listening, maybe 5%. And so we find our prayer lives are dying as we would die if we spent 95% of our time exhaling and 5% of our time inhaling. So that's a helpful analogy for me. I also think it's, you know, we have some misconceptions about prayer when it comes to God being a heavenly Santa Claus, you know. I remember reading about this fellow coming up. Well, here, I'll read it from my book here. Often we labor under the illusion that prayer must be something formal, something desperate, something absolutely magical. Eric Rohl tells the story of a little boy who was overheard praying fervently, "Tokyo, Tokyo, Tokyo." Later, when he was asked why, the boy replied, "Well, you see, I've just taken my geography exam in school, and I'm praying to the Lord to make Tokyo the capital of France." So, prayer isn't about miraculously changing the world atlas. It's primarily communicating with God. And I've fallen into that trap as well. Sometimes we think we're just about changing reality to get what we want, and sometimes what we have to do, and this is nothing anybody likes very much, is to want what we get. And to change that mindset is difficult.
Well, we're certainly not led that in our consumers, led that way in our consumerist society.
Yeah.
The idea of prayer to me, I mean, it takes so many forms. It's kind of elusive. I think of artists when they create their work, they're creating a prayer. And in particular, I think a lot of, maybe all of this divine inspiration comes from outside of us. And what a person, whether they're an artist or someone just praying in their bedroom at night when it's dark, they're trying to tune their receiving antennae to God.
Yeah.
To the divine.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think, and this is the bulk of the book is about this, about why would you want to get to know this being if this being is incredibly severe and arbitrary and violent and unlikable? And so a lot of the book takes that on. There were three things that kept me from loving God and listening to God. I call them the three H's: hell, heaven, and hypocrites. And so what helped me, and I write about this, is learning, and you know, this is something that was just revelatory for me, that God will not torture people forever. That just doesn't make sense to me, that out of love, God would ever do that. And I'm a follower of Jesus, and people who are Christians say that Jesus died for the sins of all. But Jesus only suffered, you know, a few hours. And we're saying that somebody is going to be suffering for eternity. It doesn't make logical sense to me as well. So I spend a chapter on that and get into it. And honoring the Bible, too, along the way. The other one is heaven. I really didn't want to have anything to do with heaven. Not interested in streets of gold. I don't need a mansion over the hilltop. And I figured no matter what it is, I would get bored doing it. And then I remember reading Revelation 21, verses 1 to 5, about the new earth, that we don't leave here and go home to heaven. We leave heaven and come home to this earth made new with real relationships, real loving, growing experiences taking place that, frankly, I think there will be accidents and surprises on the new earth. I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, I'm reminded of the Truman Show. You know, Truman wanted his way out because everything was all set up. And I want it all set up. I want to have some surprises. So anyway, those, and then of course hypocrites, well, they're with us now. And yeah, you know, that's the way it goes. But I'm looking forward to a time when I don't have to deal with them.
Yeah, I think our country probably more than most is hypocritical. Whatever our dark sides are, we clothe them in fancy euphemisms. Yeah. One last topic, balance.
Yeah.
Doing one's balanced best. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. I'll start with a story. I was giving a talk down in Australia, and I had 10 pastors down there listening to me. And I talked about, please don't do your best, because I don't know what it means to do my best. Is it working out physically? Till, you know, my arms are like tree trunks? Is it praying 11 hours a day? Is it serving, you know, the unhoused? What is it? How much do I put in? And what kind of set me free was the concept of balance best. I want to do my balance best, not my best. And balance best means how we're doing physically, mentally, socially, emotionally, and spiritually. And after I gave that talk about staying in balance, because this is about listening to ourselves, I can kind of sense when I'm out of balance, oh, I need some exercise. Oh, I need to have some social interaction here. Two of the pastors came up to me afterward, and they both said, that just saved my career. That
wow.
That one concept saved my career, because I'm on the verge of burnout right now.
Wow.
I can't do my best. I can do my balanced best.
Wow, this has been so inspirational. I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by local author Chris Blake, discussing non-confrontational dialogue and his new book, Searching for a God to Love. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Brian.
Hello, this is Gianna Patchen, and welcome to People in the Planet. People in the Planet highlights local environmental leaders and explores the interconnection between our communities and our Earth. I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. I work as the chapter coordinator for the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, representing San Luis Obispo County. Our chapter strives to support all SLO County communities through environmental advocacy, education, community building, and legislative engagement. A caveat that People in the Planet's guests do not represent the Sierra Club. I'm excited to welcome two guests from the Cal Poly San Luis Obispo's Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience, Aaron Pierce, the Initiative Director, and Kalea Conrad, their Strategic Initiatives Coordinator. Cal Poly SLO's Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience is building the Institute for Climate Leadership and Resilience. At the Sierra Club, I have the immense privilege of collaborating with the Cal Poly SLO Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience and their coalition of partners. Welcome, Kalea and Aaron. Thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be on the show. It's an honor.
We're happy to be here.
So stoked to dive in with y'all today. Before we start, can you introduce yourselves to our audience?
So my name is Aaron Pierce. I'm a professor of mathematics at Cal Poly and the director of the Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience.
And I'm Kalea Conrad. I am the Strategic Initiatives Coordinator for the Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience.
In addition, we're working with the SLO Climate Coalition. Full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of the SLO Climate Coalition. And so the work that we're doing for Zero Footprint off campus is being supported by the Climate Coalition.
So could you share with us a bit more about what y'all do with this initiative on campus?
The Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience is engaged in a bunch of activities on campus, mostly around student activities and curriculum development. We also support the College Corps Fellowship, which has climate action as one of its goals. And we put on an annual virtual conference, Climate Solutions Now, which showcases what climate solutions actually look like. It's a very nebulous term, and it's aimed at helping students understand how they can take their skills and major and make a career in a sustainable field from that. And then we also do community-based participatory research, which is a bit of a mouthful, but basically it means that I talk with folks at local nonprofits or government agencies, and we look at actions that they're working on that have tasks that can be carved off and given to students to do in the context of coursework.
Well, today we're here to dive into a very specific program that y'all are working on, the effort to implement Zero Footprint across San Luis Obispo County. Could you start us off with what is Zero Footprint?
Yeah. Zero Footprint is a 501c3 that is working to accelerate the transition to regenerative agriculture. They are doing so by partnering with the food and beverage industry to provide an option for customers and the business itself to contribute directly to climate action, specifically contributing to a grant fund that farmers can apply for when they're seeking funding to implement one or many regenerative practices. Some of those practices can be compost application, purchasing cover crop seed, equipment assistance, and planting hedgerows, things like that, all with the aim to improve soil health over time. So this project or this nonprofit and being a partner of this nonprofit allows customers to directly contribute to climate solutions with every meal purchase that they make at a participating restaurant.
So that sounds really wonderful. Could you explain a little bit more what that would look like from a business owner's perspective and from a customer's perspective if Zero Foodprint is part of that transaction?
Yeah. So as a business owner, all that is required is a line item change in the point of sale system to add some kind of surcharge called like 1% for healthy soil or whatever they want to call it. And then customers would have the option to opt out if they want to withhold those extra cents from their purchase. It doesn't take any training for their staff, and Zero Foodprint helps every step of the way to make that possible. Do you want to add anything to that from the business perspective?
That's basically it. I mean, like a 1% optional fee is added on to the tab as an opt-out. So you can choose not to pay it if you want. In practice, pretty much everybody does because it's a penny on the dollar. So, you know, you buy lunch or whatever and it costs $25 and they tack on 25 cents to go towards this fund for farmers. So it's pretty minimal.
So from the customer perspective, if you go to eat out at a participating restaurant, say in downtown San Luis Obispo at some point, that's the goal, you will likely see like a little flyer that explains that this restaurant is a participant and where those funds go. So it would say...
And that it's optional.
And that it's optional, of course. Yeah. So this is an optional micro donation that is baked into the total cost of your meal that goes directly to local farm projects to regenerate soil. All of the funds are actually traceable and verifiable, and Zero Foodprint is measuring impact through this Comet Planner tool. And then on their bill, when they purchase the meal, it will say at the bottom, 1% for collective regeneration or 1% for healthy soil or whatever the restaurant wants it to say. That will be 1% of the pre-tax total. Anyone who doesn't want to participate can just say opt out when they're making that purchase and it's withheld from the total.
That's so exciting. So it makes contributing to regenerative agriculture and soil health a really easy thing for our community members to do.
Exactly.
It's designed to be frictionless. It just happens. You don't have to pull out your phone and like sign up to make a donation. You don't have to take any action on your own. You just can like let it happen with a smile and a nod.
So could you share a little more about the role that y'all are playing at the Cal Poly Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience? How are you helping lead this campaign locally? Why are we bringing this to San Luis Obispo?
Well, we're supporting it because it's just a really good idea. I mean, it suits this area so well. There's a lot of positivity towards sustainability and farm to table and, you know, sort of organic food and everything else. And also San Luis Obispo as a sustainable tourist destination. So this amplifies a whole bunch of those things. It also, there's a very symbiotic relationship with the other work that we're doing on sustainable agriculture or climate smart agriculture. It helps fund that agriculture. I don't know if you've heard, but there's been some upset at the federal level with regard to agricultural funding recently. And so a lot of those federal dollars are in question or have been explicitly removed from the budget. So this provides a way for, to provide a stream of funds to farmers that no longer have USAID contracts and no longer have USDA funding without tapping into any public dollars.
That's amazing. And that connection between supporting local small farmers and also that tie to climate resilience is really special to me, that these efforts are interconnected, right?
Yes. And I should also add that there's sort of two more pieces to the circular economy. One is that if you are a farmer that supplies a business that's participating in the program, then you get an automatic priority boost for your grant applications. So the way that Zero Food Print determines who gets funded is they look at the grant applications and they calculate the estimated carbon impact, and that's what they use as their chief scoring rubric. But then if you were supplying a partner, then you get another bump. And so then that also helps keep the money local and keep the money moving circularly. The other thing is that at the moment, all the money goes into a statewide fund for farmers across California. But if we can get enough, like if we can achieve critical mass locally, then Zero Food Print will work with us to set up a local commission that will get to determine the prioritization of the grant proposals. And then that would further enable us to direct the money locally.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. Today, I'm talking with Aaron Pierce and Kalea Conrad from the Cal Poly San Luis Obispo's Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience. Could you share a bit about your campaign to get more San Luis Obispo County and Central Coast businesses and what kind of projects you've seen come about as Cal Poly's campaign to support Zero Food Print has gone forward?
Yeah, so we have approached partnership implementation like twofold. So we are working at the Cal Poly campus scale, and then we are also working in the broader SLO community. Cal Poly's efforts are driven by an outreach team that are presenting very basically what the Zero Food Print partnership would look like and if it were implemented in Cal Poly campus dining. And then we're surveying students to determine if there is support. Turns out there's overwhelming support for this type of partnership. 95% approval rating for implementing a partnership in all campus dining facilities at Cal Poly, and 84% in approval of a one-time contribution at the time of meal plan purchasing for first years and maybe second years. And then on the broader community level, I have been working to do outreach to just make restaurants and businesses aware that this is a new opportunity for them. It's very slow going. It takes a lot of repeat exposure to the concept. It's a relatively new approach to sustainability in the restaurant business. It's like a very simple commitment can have very significant impact. But I think that because it's a new approach, many restaurants are just hesitant and waiting to see who's going to do it first. And then I think it might gain some traction, but it does cost almost nothing. And it delivers huge brand value through high impact storytelling with credible sustainability certifications. So it's a super huge lever for restaurants to incorporate it into their brand and demonstrate that they are truly committed to sustainable dining. So we do have a brand new Zero Food Print partner, the very first one on the Central Coast, Beerwood and Los Osos. We're super, super proud to announce that to our Central Coast community, and we're excited to support them every step of the way and show them that we do care as a community about our agricultural land, especially in an agricultural county.
That's really great. And I love that you highlighted that Cal Poly campus is looking to take on Zero Food Print. It doesn't necessarily have to just be a restaurant or a small business like we think of, but these larger institutions could be helping take on these efforts.
Yeah, I mean, conceptually, it makes most sense for it to be a business that's in the food or drink industry, but it doesn't have to be. It could be a print shop or a hotel or whatever. I mean, anybody that, you know, cares about supporting regenerative agriculture because it's such an important climate solution can participate.
So if Zero Food Print is only 1% of the sale, that's only 1 cent for every dollar spent.
That's right.
Can a program like this really make an impact?
Yeah, so those little cents add up in a big way. So just to put it in perspective, last year in SLO County, spending on restaurants and food stores was something like $750 million. And last year, spending on hotels and motels and such was like almost $1.5 billion. So if we just have 5% participation, we'd be able to collect over $1 million annually in funding from these tiny micro donations.
Wow. And that's just talking about the Central Coast. If we implemented 5% of those businesses here on the Central Coast.
That's just talking about SLO County. That's not even the full Central Coast.
Wow. That is really exciting to talk about and to see grassroots ways that we can be supporting this regenerative agriculture and small farms across the state of California. So a question for y'all. How can our listeners support Zero Food Print, whether they grow food, sell food, or eat food? And I think that includes every single person. How can folks support this program and help see Zero Food Print implemented in more spaces across Slo County?
Well, they can definitely reach out to us to find out more about the program and how to approach businesses to tell them about it. We can use all the help that we can get in terms of encouraging businesses to join the program. And we have materials actually that people can leave with businesses to, you know, encourage them and to provide information about the program.
The email that you can reach us at regarding Zero Food Print is zfp@slowclimatecoalition.org.
So to repeat that for our listeners, that's zfp@slowclimatecoalition.org.
The other thing about this program is that it gives people a way to contribute to climate action on a day-to-day basis. Climate is such a big challenge that and kind of a nebulous one for many people, that it can be daunting, and not everybody's in a position to get solar panels on their house, and not everybody can afford an EV, and those aren't necessarily the most impactful solutions anyways, actually. There's lots of other things that you can do that are much better for the climate, like skip eating meat today, for example. But this is a small thing. It's basically effortless, and it can make a huge, huge impact, because unlike some other sectors, agriculture has the potential to actually be carbon negative. And at the same time, the way that regenerative agriculture operates is by building up the ecosystem that's underneath the ground. So we don't think of the ground as being alive, but there's more living and formerly living, dead material made up of microorganisms under the ground than you would possibly imagine. So like one teaspoon of healthy soil has more microbes in it than there are humans on Earth,
wow.
Right? And so that's a lot of potential for sequestering carbon. And so the plants absorb the carbon and they do their photosynthesis thing, convert it into sugars. And those sugars, those are carbon molecules. Those get passed down to the microorganisms and it just gets buried in the earth. So you have this fantastic drawdown mechanism for reducing atmospheric carbon dioxide that you get by partnering with nature. And it allows it to take place incrementally. I guess we didn't mention this before, but if you're going to go organic, you basically need to make your whole farm organic, or else have some sort of distinction or separation between the parts that are and aren't, because there can be cross-contamination. But with regenerative ag, you can do it an acre at a time as you have funding to implement. And so the zero footprint or collective regeneration model supports that incremental transition.
That's amazing. And that just allows more folks to get onto this transition and support
exactly.
that. Rather than all or nothing, do what you can when you can, which I think is a great motto in any environmental work and any efforts to mitigate the climate crisis. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Gianna.
Thank you so much for having us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
That was Aaron Pierce and Kalea Conrad from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo's Initiative for Climate Leadership and Resilience. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Gianna Patchen, and you're listening to People and the Planet.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music is by Gary Eister. I'm Monica Lopez. And a big announcement, Issues and Ideas is taking a break over the holidays and into the new year, but we'll be back with your favorite contributors and maybe a few surprises. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2026. This is KCBX.